Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Adam Smythe. He's professor of English literature and the history of the book at Balliol College in University of Oxford, and we're talking about his book. Boy, did I find this fascinating. The Bookmakers, A History of the Book in 18 Lives. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me along.
This is a book about books, as you write, but it's really about the people who created the physical object of the book. And I love the fact that you did that. This is really a human-centered book.
That's correct. I wanted exactly right. I wanted to tell the story of the history of the printed book from really the late 15th century right through to now, and all the different forms that print and books had taken, from the grand and the monumental to the ephemeral sheet in our hands. But I wanted to do that, to organize that around the lives of individuals, bookmakers who had done things with the physical form of the book. So I really wanted to humanize the book as a medium, and to humanize print as a technology, and to think about it as an expression of the personalities of the binders and the pressmen and the publishers and the librarians and the collectors and all the other variously eccentric and compelling individuals who did amazing things with print.
The range in this book is just incredible, from the very first volumes printed in Britain to, as you mentioned, ephemera. In each case, there are certain people involved who have a vision of the book. And the great thing is, it's not necessarily the vision, the idea of a book that most people have. There are people who really experiment with the form of the book. And those are the people I found most fascinating, who decided to do something a little bit different that would change the idea of a book.
Yes, the book in some ways is a constantly recognizable form to us. If we were to look at a book from about 1500, we had one on our desk in front of us now, we would know what to do with it and how to turn the pages and how to navigate it. And that's part of the power of the book through time. But it also has done different things and taken slightly different forms. And I wanted to draw that out as your question is suggesting. A good example of that is in the 1620s and 1630s, there's a completely fascinating, strange, learned Anglican religious community that sets up.
I love this chapter. First of all, that building is still there, that church.
Yes, the chapel at Little Gidding is still there.
And these two women, Maria and Anna Colette, cut up, first of all, when people first read this, it may sound blasphemous, but they cut up Bibles.
They did. They did. They were in a religious community that wanted to do various pious acts of remembrance and charity. And one of the things they did was bookmaking, and that took the form, as you suggest, was of acquiring printed gospels, a printed text telling the life of Christ. And then they were interested in the difference between these various gospels, and they would respond to that by slicing up with knives and scissors, cutting up the pages at the level of a sentence or the level of the word, sometimes even individual words sliced in two. And then they would reorder that printed text and then glue it down in a new order and then add in various images and it to produce these beautiful forms. And they look a bit to us like ransom notes or, you know, the cover of the Sex Pistols album or something deeply strange. But for them, I think they were acts of devotion, of slow, engaged reflection on the Gospels. And they're brilliant books because they're tricky objects to categorize. They're handmade and bespoke. Each one was different, and they're the product of scissors and glue and care and hours and hours and hours. So they come out of that medieval manuscript tradition of producing beautiful illuminated manuscripts. But they're also things of print. They are about printed text, which were printed quickly and sold widely, but then were acquired and cut up and scrambled and reordered. So they're part manuscript, part print. They look a bit like a book, but they look a bit like a medieval manuscript. They look like acts of destruction in some ways, because texts have been cut up. And for us in the 21st century, religious texts, that looks like a taboo. But I think they're expressions of the opposite, of devotion and piety and a kind of careful, reverential creativity. So they're the kind of object that hasn't found a place in a traditional history of the book, but it's so important and so deeply weird, and I mean weird in an entirely positive sense.
But it also shows you that people had a broader idea of what a book was over the centuries. You know, people would think about the books from the 1600s, 1700s as something precious that people would take care of and wouldn't want to. But one of the things, some of the essays tell me in this book that people had a much more hands-on idea about what a book could be. There was the idea over 100 years later of extra illustrations by Charlotte and Alexander Sutherland. And that was another thing, a case of cutting up a book and producing something different.
Yeah, that's right. Extra illustrations, sometimes it's called Grangerizing. This extremely interesting practice of acquiring a bound book, often a history chronicle, or sometimes the plays of Shakespeare, some fairly canonical, well-known text, and then disbinding it, in other words, taking the binding out and separating out into individual leads, and then acquiring gradually, ideally over years and years and years, lots and lots of prints and images and other visual stuff relating to the text. And then you would insert your images. If you're reading Henry IV Part II, every time Falstaff is mentioned, your various prints of Falstaff would go in. Or every time Charles I is referenced in your history of the English Civil War, you'd put your prints in. And then you'd fill the book until it became a bigger and thing. And there's this couple called Charlotte, led by Charlotte Alexander Sutherland, whose collection are now in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, who took two-volume history chronicles and through this process of expansion, of adding more and more in, produced a couple of hundred volumes of the same text, but expanded because it had all these images in. So it really used the book not as a fixed, finished thing, and I think this is the kind of interesting thing to think about. The book wasn't a fixed, stable, finished object for them. It was a starting point, really, for organizing and holding all this other visual material, and the book expanded and expanded and expanded. And they got a lot of criticism at the time for, again, seemingly destructive acts. They would take their books apart, they would add new stuff in. They weren't too worried about the original author's intention. They were thinking about the book as a kind of holder, like a filing cabinet. But they were producing these wonderfully intriguing, creative objects that just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and it became a craze in the 19th century, extra illustration.
It's amazing how the books expanded, too. Like a single volume, as you write about in the book, became 36 large folio volumes.
It is amazing.
And this is a project you would do throughout your life if you were doing this. You would be collecting these prints from all over hither and yon, and you may not even finish it within your life.
Many of the extant extra illustrated volumes are multi-generational things, because there are always more prints to collect. There's always another image of Charles I on a horse. You can never stop. And so the thing goes on and it goes on and it grows and grows. And I think that's part of its power. And I think its power is that it's a response to the fixity of the book, of the print, the idea that this thing is closed and finished and definitive. And there's something very compelling in that idea.
Oh,
of completion.
Yeah.
But there's something very unsettling and troubling as well, that this object can be expanded no more. An extra illustration was a kind of blowing apart of the printed book in order to make it grow and grow and grow.
Now, I do want to mention that there were people who really viewed this as bibliographical vandalism. It was like, and people talked about it in books. There was Bibliomania or Book Madness by Thomas Frognall Dibdin, or The Anatomy of Bibliomania. I have to read both of those books by Holbrook Jackson. These people really were disturbed by the fact that this was going on.
I think, that's absolutely true. And they often described it in terms of ailment or disease or malady or kind of frenzy. Often there was a gender component to that. They were particularly troubled by people like Charlotte Sutherland, women who were doing this kind of activity. And I think also it seemed to take away control and power from authors and also from publishers, and it put it back in the hands of the reader. The reader was the one who was augmenting and building and expanding the book, rather than with deference reading the great words of these writers. They were adding in more and more of themselves. So there was something wonderfully anarchic about the whole process that unsettled more conservative voices from the 19th century, definitely.
By the way, I want a special shout out to Holbrook Jackson. In your book, page 204 to 205, you talk about him reading during the toilet, the ritual of the toilet, especially the part of it devoted to quaffing. So let me ask you, do you read while you quaff?
I think I probably may have done. I mean, not every day, but I definitely read all over the place. I mean, I read walking and traveling, and and if we include audiobooks, of course, then all other, you know, cycling and running, and, you know, books are amazing because they let you do that. They have that mobile quality. I just went for a walk just now, just now before speaking to you, and I had a book in my pocket and read a bit and then tucked it away and carried on walking. So we can read anywhere, and that mobility is one of the great powers of books.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Adam Smythe, professor of English literature and the history of the book at Balliol College, University of Oxford, and we're talking about his book. There are great digressions throughout this whole book. The Bookmakers, A History of the Book in 18 Lives. I love the incident that you describe. In the introduction of the book, you're reading a book, I think it's Margaret Cavendish's Poems and Fancies, 1664. Mm. And what happened?
Well, this was a kind of key origin point in my thinking about the book and deciding to write this book. When I was in the Bodleian Library in Oxford reading Margaret Cavendish's collections of poetry. Now, Cavendish is this amazing 17th century woman. She's a writer. She's a scientist. She's the first woman to attend Royal Society meetings, although she wasn't allowed to join because of her gender. She was a brilliant mind, the founder of something like science fiction but way back in the 17th century. And this was a book of hers that I was reading, and I was turning the pages reading her poems. And then I noticed in the margin of one of these pages, in the blank margin, a kind of smudge, an inky smudge, and I looked closer, and I could see these little swirls, and then I realized it was a fingerprint, absolutely a fingerprint, and it must have been the fingerprint of the man who printed this page, and one of the men of several who printed this particular volume. So this is way back in 1664, in the print shop of a printer called William Wilson. He would have employed some, to us now nameless, compositors or pressmen who did the grunt work, and this was the fingerprint of one of them. And it was a powerful moment when I suddenly saw this collection of poems by Margaret Cavendish, both as a literary work full of these ideas and themes and narratives, but also as a physical object that had a material quality to it. And that sense of the book, both as text, both as story or poem or narrative, but also as object, having weight and body, it's really interesting to me. And in this book, The Bookmakers, I'm interested in thinking about the book as an object that kind of flickers between those two states, carrying text out into the world, but also being an object in itself, and an object that in some ways tells its own history. If we look at a book from the 17th century, it's very likely to be covered with marks and annotations, handwritten annotations by readers from the 17th century. Or the binding has a particular quality that we can begin to think about, or the type has a particular quality, or there are scribble financial records in the back, or there's a bookmark that's been left tucked in, or there are provenance notes of book stamps by previous readers. And all these markers tell us the story of the way this book as an object moves through time from the 17th century to now. And I love that sense of books telling the stories of narratives and novels and poems, but also telling us the stories of their material lives, how they got into the world, where they went, who owned them, how they moved around, how they reached us now, and also where they will go next. One of the amazing things about a book like Cavendish's poems from 1664 is that I'm reading it in the Bodleian, and it's was printed 350 years before, but it will certainly carry on after me, and there'll be readers hundreds of years afterwards who will look at it too. So that doubleness the books have as both texts but also objects that carry in the marks on the books their own histories is something I wanted to think about in this book.
The first chapter about printing introduces the person, and forgive me if I mispronounce his name, Wynkyn de Worde.
That's good. Let's go with that.
Okay. He's from the mid-16th century. Right off the bat, I'm fascinated that his books, some of them survive and are known only from fragments, pages glued together as binding supports. Explain that thing that happens.
Yeah. So this is Wynkyn de Worde, or Wynkyn de Worde, who's a Dutchman, we think, who learned his skills working with the great early English printer, William Caxton, but not in England, in Northern Europe, in Cologne, in Bruges, in Ghent, and then comes to England in the 1470s in the area that became Fleet Street and that became associated in the later centuries with print and with newspapers. But Wynkyn de Worde sets up his shop where he lives above and prints below, and produces a huge amount of early, relatively cheap books in English for a relatively popular audience. So he's the first printer in England to really see the democratizing potential of the printing press, for the power the printing press has to get word out to men and also women. He was very interested in women readers below the elite level in particular. He publishes lots of guides to history, lots of translations of Greek and Latin texts if your languages aren't quite up to it, lots of jest books, lots of works of what we would call literature. And he publishes loads and loads and loads of titles, something like 15% of all texts before 1550 have come out of his print shop. But you're right, lots of them, some of them survive, and miraculously so, and you can call them up in libraries all over the world, and it's amazing to have these objects which have passed through the centuries before us, but lots of them don't. And in a kind of paradox of popularity, the ones that were read intently and widely are often the ones that crumbled and disappeared. They were kind of read to pieces. And some of those popular ones only survive because bits of the pages were repurposed and used in the binding of later books.
Wow.
Often in the 16th to 17th century, binders looking for essentially scrap paper or sturdy bits of vellum or a nice bit of paper to put down on the inside of the boards, would tear up an unwanted book or reach for sheets that have kind of crumbled apart and then paste that in or stitch it in or sew it in. And often, this happens quite often, and so when you're reading, kind of magically, when you're reading a 16th, 17th century book, you often see these little pieces like ghosts or limbs of older titles, which we no longer have, but which survive as supports for these kind of host titles that we do have. And that was the case in lots and lots of Wynkyn de Worde titles. He published a lovely conduct book for children in 1492. So, you know, this is a long time ago, the year Columbus sails. It's deep in the historical past. And it crumbles apart and disappears, except for a copy that was left on the floor, it seems, and then repurposed by a binder and used to pad out a later volume. And so we just have these little shards or little pieces of what once was a guide for children, telling them how to sit up straight, and how to play the lute, and what to read, and how to eat with good manners and so on. So there's this lovely sense of a bookish past that was once very loud and vivid and read widely, hanging by this very narrow historical thread. But it is there if you look carefully in the binding and pull out these pieces of text that just about survive.
As you write, he had a highly visual approach to the book. He reimagined the nature and the function of the title page. And that's one of those things we all take it for granted now, that every book would have a title page. That was not so originally.
That's right. Handwritten manuscript text didn't have separate title pages, really, because they were usually many texts were usually contained within one large manuscript. And then early printed texts were offered with no separate title page, but they started to have a kind of wraparound front, a kind of blank page, which was just simply to keep the ink and the dirt and the damage away from the beginning of the book. And then a few innovators began to scribble down a note of the title or the printer occasionally, very rarely the author. In these early days of printing, authors had very, very little status. People were not terribly interested in where the text came from in terms of the writer, much more interested in the printer and the publisher. And then that wraparound page got slightly more details added, and then early printers, including crucially Wynkyn de Worde, started to put the title of the book and the location of his print shop and where you could acquire copies if you wanted to buy them. So it's a good example of, yeah, as you say, his visual imagination, his visual acumen. He included lots and lots of woodcuts in his early printed texts beautiful historiated, illustrated initials, and his books have a witty, accessible human quality as a result, as we see these lovely woodcuts staring out at us.
In many ways, he sort of reminded me of the way the tail ends were used by Thomas Buick. He had these illustrations. Some of them would repeat throughout the text.
Yeah.
But it was, again, a very visual thing. Not only did he do that, but he also published lots of books in foreign languages. He did the first books in Britain in Hebrew and Arabic.
Yes.
And the first use of italics.
Yeah, that's right. He was a really radical figure, and he's working at a time, the late 15th, early 16th century, where there's this great intellectual movement that we would now call humanism, whereby scholars and learned individuals were interested in looking back to the classics, to Latin and Greek, translating them, also interested in Arabic, rewriting them, putting those texts into circulation in London. Because he was a great democratizer, but he was also interested in what was going on around him intellectually, was part of that movement and printed texts using Hebrew and Arabic letters, for example, often lacking the hardware for Arabic in particular. He didn't have the letters to print Arabic in the way he wanted, so he would cut the letters out of wood, individual letter forms out of wood, and print them. And they have a kind of endearingly improvised amateurish quality when we see them on the page now. But what he's trying to do there is find a way to print in Arabic at a time in London when that isn't possible and no one else is doing that. And that's a radical thing to be doing in the 1580s and 1590s.
Yeah, people may be surprised, but there's a great chapter on Benjamin Franklin as a printer. And a lot of times we don't even learn about that here in the States. But that brings up the idea of ephemeral texts, and you write about ephemeral texts as being very, very common. At that time, there was a world of transient texts. That's a quote from your book. People don't realize that print was read, and then all sorts of things happened to the print. It was dropped, I like this quote, lost, lit pipes, stopped mustard pots, or wrapped pies, or used as toilet paper. That's what happened to many of these transient texts.
That's right. And I mean, we might traditionally, histories of the book tell a story of kind of monumental books, understandably big, physically big, culturally weighty books like Shakespeare's First Folio that had its 400th anniversary last year, or Birds of America, or the Kelmscott Chaucer printed by William Morris in the 1890s. And these are all obviously crucial, massive, important, fascinating texts. But most printing wasn't like that at all. Most printing was cheap, quick, single sheet printing, and that's what kept printers alive commercially and occupied much of their time. And that goes right back to the origins of printing in the time of Gutenberg in 1450s in Mainz in Germany. He produces his astonishing Gutenberg Bible, Latin Bible, which survives today in multiple copies, which is huge and beautiful. That's undoubtedly amazing. But he's also printing single-sheet indulgences, which are little scraps of paper, forms, pre-printed forms for confession, in which you complete your details of your transgressions and bring them along to confession. And they're like checks in that they're printed, but you fill in the details. And they fall to the ground, but a few of them survive. And that's a history, that cheap, popular, everyday, quotidian printing that runs right through the centuries. And Benjamin Franklin, as you say, long before he becomes such a crucial, remarkable political, cultural, scientific figure, makes his money and rises to prominence as a printer. And he produces some books, some translations of the classics, and some novels coming over from England. But really what makes his money and establishes him is his printing of banknotes, his printing of newspapers, and also his printing of almanacs, which are it's a form that survives in North America in a way it doesn't in England anymore. The almanac is a cheap kind of diary, everyday, helpful guide to the days and months of the year. That's how he makes his money. He's not producing the kind of works one would expect to see in some exhibition at the Library of Congress or something. He's producing everyday stuff. And print has that has a history of landmark publications that are massive and important, absolutely, but it also has a powerful history, which is everyday, cheap, transient, the stuff that flutters through the air as you walk down the street in Philadelphia in the 18th century or walk through Fleet Street in the 1490s past Wink and the Words Place. That's what print is producing all the time.
The conclusion you write about in your epilogue is that books are expressive objects. People have a tendency to look at books as fixed objects, but it's not so simple.
That's right. I wanted to think about books as made by people, not by machines, and expressive of their ambitions and their ideals and their failures and their idiosyncrasies. And the chapters in my book, I think, tell a story about particular forms of the book as made by particular individuals. And I wanted to draw a connection between those individuals and those books. One of the figures I talk about is this remarkable kind of fallen aristocrat.
Adam, we're completely out of time.
Okay, sure.
But that means if people are listening, you need to read the book. My guest tonight has been Adam Smythe, professor of English literature and the history of the book at Balliol College in the University of Oxford. And we're talking about his book. Boy, is this book is history at its finest, but also so much fun. The Bookmakers, A History of the Book in 18 Lives. Adam, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.